Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're looking into something called ineffective esophageal motility, or IEM. It sounds technical, maybe, but it's about something pretty common, how food travels down your throat.
That's a good way to frame it. It's about the rhythm, you know, of the esophagus getting a bit off. For this deep dive, we've looked at a detailed medical report, a great overview from the Cleveland Clinic, and several newer research papers, too.
Right.
So our aim here is to really pull together the key pieces. What is IEM? Why does it happen? How is it diagnosed? And importantly, what can be done about it and what's new in the field?
Exactly. We want to make it clear without getting bogged down in, you know, super technical stuff. And have you ever had that feeling like food is just sort of sticking?
Well, we're going to explore a possible reason for that and what doctors are learning. Okay, so let's dive in. What exactly is ineffective esophageal motility?
Okay, so in simple terms, it's a problem with those muscle contractions in the esophagus, the wave-like one.
Peristalsis, right. Exactly, peristalsis. Those waves normally move food down smoothly. With IEM, the contractions might be weak or maybe not well coordinated. Sometimes they just don't happen in the right order.
So, like, the escalator for your food is a bit sluggish?
That's a perfect analogy, yeah. Sometimes it's just not moving things along efficiently.
Okay, so how do doctors actually measure that sluggishness? Is there a specific test?
Yes, there is. And this involves a key measurement called the distal contractile integral, or DCI. You get this measurement during a test called high-resolution manometry, HRM for short.
HRM.
Think of it like mapping the pressure all along your esophagus while you swallow. And IEM is diagnosed when at least half, 50% or more of the swallows show a DCI below a certain number. That number is 450 millimeter HG centimeters.
Okay, 450. So it's a measure of the contraction force, basically. What about the valve at the bottom, the LES? Does that play a role here?
It does, yeah. It's actually crucial. For an IEM diagnosis, that lower esophageal sphincter, the LES, it has to be relaxing normally. They measure that relaxation, too. It's called the integrated relaxation pressure, or IRP, and it has to be below the normal limit. So, you know, with IEM, the problem isn't usually a jammed exit door.
Right.
It's more that the wave pushing the food towards the door just isn't strong enough.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So if this IEM shows up on someone's test, is it always a big deal?
Well, not necessarily. And this is really interesting. IEM exists on a spectrum. It can be quite mild, maybe just over half the swallows are ineffective, or it can be severe, where it's more like 70% or even more.
Okay.
And that severity matters. Particularly, severe IEM is linked pretty strongly with more acid reflux, especially when you're lying down.
Ah. Because gravity isn't helping clear things out.
Exactly. But milder cases, they often stay stable and might not cause someone major problems day to day.
That's good to know. You mentioned it might not always cause symptoms. How often do they find this in people who feel totally fine?
This is actually quite surprising. A study suggests IEM might be found in up to 17% of healthy people, people with no symptoms at all.
Wow, 17%. That's higher than I'd expect.
It really is. It tells you that an HRM finding doesn't automatically equal a disease that needs treatment, you know.
Right. So that DCI number is key for the HRM diagnosis, but it doesn't directly measure if the food itself is moving down well.
Precisely. The DCI threshold, that 450, is related to whether food usually moves okay, what we call reliable bolus transit. But measuring the actual movement of the food isn't technically part of the core IEM diagnosis itself.
Okay, got it. So we have a definition. But maybe we should back up a tiny bit. How is the esophagus supposed to work? Just the basics.
Good idea. So think of the esophagus as this muscular tube, layered muscles. How food moves relies on a few things. There's preload. That's the stretch on the muscle when food enters.
Okay.
Then there's afterload, the resistance it pushes against, mainly from that LES valve at the bottom.
Right.
And then, of course, there's just the raw strength of the muscle contraction itself, contractility.
And I think I read somewhere that more stretch can mean a stronger squeeze. Is that right?
Yeah, basically. Think of it like Laplace's law in simple terms. More stretch, or just stronger muscles to begin with, means they can generate more pressure to push things down. It's basic muscle physics, really.
Helpful visual. Is the control mechanism the same all the way down?
Not quite. There's a difference between the upper part and the lower part. The initial wave, primary peristalsis, starts when you swallow. Up top, it's striated muscle, kind of like your bicep. That's under direct control from the brainstem.
Okay, direct line.
Yep. Lower down, it's smooth muscle, and the control is more indirect through local nerve networks called ganglia within the esophageal wall. Plus, stretch receptors in the esophagus itself also trigger reflexes to help things along.
Hmm. So it's quite a complex coordination of nerves and muscles just for a single swallow.
It really is something we completely take for granted most of the time.
So a problem anywhere in that chain, brain signals, nerves, the muscle itself, could mess with motility. Now, IEM is one specific type of esophageal dysmotility. What are some other reasons the esophagus might have trouble moving food?
Right, so dysmotility is the big umbrella term. There are primary disorders, ones that start in the esophagus, like achalasia, that's where the LES just doesn't relax properly.
Okay.
Or eosinophilic esophagitis, EOE, where inflammation actually narrows the tube.
Hmm.
And then things like esophageal spasms, those really strong, painful, uncoordinated squeezes.
And then you have issues elsewhere in the body that can affect the esophagus.
Yeah.
Secondary causes.
Exactly. And some of these are specifically linked to IEM appearing on tests. Connective tissue diseases like scleroderma can damage the smooth muscle.
Right. I've heard of that.
Chagas disease, which is parasitic, can impact nerves involved in swallowing. Esophageal sclerosis, that's a thickening of the tissue, often related to scleroderma too.
Okay.
Cancerous tumors, obviously, can cause blockages and disrupt movement. And other structural things, ulcers, strictures from scarring, general inflammation.
And neurological issues too.
Yes, definitely. Neurological or neuromuscular disorders that affect nerve or muscle control anywhere can potentially impact the esophagus.
So again, IEM is what the test shows.
Right.
But the why behind it can be varied or sometimes maybe even unclear.
That sums it up perfectly. It's a finding, and figuring out the root cause can be the next step, or sometimes we don't find a specific one.
Okay, so we know what it is, potential causes.
Yeah.
But what does it feel like? If someone has IEM, what symptoms might they notice?
Well, first, remember what we said, maybe nothing.
Right, the asymptomatic group.
Exactly. But when symptoms do happen, they usually tie back to that ineffective food movement. Difficulty swallowing, dysphagia is a big one. That sensation of food getting stuck.
Yeah.
Chest pain, sometimes after eating, is another. And that can be tricky because, you know, it can mimic heart pain.
That sounds worrying. What else?
Heartburn can be a feature, especially, as we mentioned, with more severe IEM, possibly linked to poor acid clearance in GER.
Okay.
Regurgitation food or liquid coming back up can happen. If eating becomes difficult or painful, some people might lose weight, unfortunately. And if stuff backs up towards the airway, you could get coughing or choking.
So quite a range, and it really varies from person to person.
Absolutely. Symptom severity is very individual.
Okay, let's talk diagnosis again. You mentioned HRM, high-resolution manometry, is the key test.
Yes, that's really the gold standard for assessing esophageal function these days. And we use standardized criteria, currently the Chicago Classification version 3.0, to interpret those HRM results.
Right.
And those criteria define IEM, again, as 50% ineffective swallows, with that DCI under 450, plus the normally relaxing LES.
You also mentioned weak versus failed contractions before. Can you explain that difference a bit more?
Sure. HRM lets us see just how weak these contractions are. A weak sequence has a DCI between 100 and 450. So there's some squeeze, but it's not enough.
Okay.
A failed sequence is even weaker DCI below 100. Very little effective propulsion there. Now, both count towards the 50% needed for an IEM diagnosis, but having more of those failed ones might mean more significant issues with food transit and maybe more reflux.
I see. So the test isn't just a few sips of water, is it?
Right.
You mentioned provocative maneuvers. What are those about?
Right. They're really important. They help us see how the esophagus performs under a bit more stress, you know? A key one is the multiple rapid swallows, or MRS. You take several swallows of water back to back quickly.
Okay, what does that show?
It tests something called contraction reserve. Basically, can the esophageal muscles ramp up their strength when stimulated repeatedly?
Ah, interesting.
If someone has good reserve, their DCI gets much stronger with the rapid swallows. That might suggest a better outlook. It can even influence surgical decisions, like for reflux surgery. Good reserve might mean it's safer to do a standard procedure.
That's fascinating. Using the test results to predict surgical outcomes, are there other maneuvers used?
Yep. Sometimes they'll have you swallow something solid, like bread or a marshmallow, to see if that changes things compared to liquids.
Makes sense.
A standardized test meal can be given to see if it actually reproduces the symptoms the person experiences. And there's a rapid drink challenge, drinking a larger volume quickly, which can sometimes highlight problems at the junction with the stomach.
So HRM gives a really detailed functional picture. Are there other tests commonly used specifically for IEM diagnosis?
Well, things like adding impedance measurement to the manometry can tell us more about bolus movement.
Right.
But they aren't officially part of the Chicago classification criteria for diagnosing IEM itself right now. There are newer tools being explored, though. Things like measuring baseline impedance or mucosal impedance, which tell us about the health of the esophageal lining. And another one is the functional lumen imaging probe, or FLIP.
FLIP, what does that do?
FLIP uses a balloon to measure how easily the esophagus stretches, its distensibility, particularly down at the junction with the stomach. It gives different information than pressure measurements.
Okay, so the diagnostic toolbox is definitely expanding.
It is, yeah.
But let's get to treatment. If someone has IEM and it is causing symptoms, what can actually be done?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And the tough answer right now is that we don't have a specific medication or cure that reliably makes those weak esophageal contractions stronger in IEM.
Ah, okay. So no magic bullet to fix the muscle itself.
Not yet, unfortunately. So the focus really shifts to managing the symptoms the person is having and dealing with any related conditions.
Right. Symptom management, what does that typically involve?
Well, if heartburn or GERD is a big part of the picture, then medications like proton pump inhibitors, PPIs, are often the first line to reduce acid.
Standard reflux treatment.
Exactly. And also lifestyle things for reflux dietary changes, maybe weight management, elevating the head of the bed for sleep, all that helps.
What about those prokinetic drugs you mentioned earlier, the ones meant to speed up digestion?
They are sometimes tried, but honestly, the evidence that they specifically help improve the esophageal contractions in IEM is pretty limited. It's still an area being researched, but they aren't a go-to solution for IEM itself right now.
Okay. And you talked about contraction reserve affecting surgery decisions for reflux.
Yes, that's a really important point. If someone has IEM and bad reflux and they're thinking about surgery like a fundoplication,
where they wrap the stomach around the esophagus.
Right, to tighten that LES. But if that person's HRM showed poor contraction reserve, meaning their esophagus muscles couldn't power up during the MRS test,
then tightening in the valve might make swallowing harder.
Precisely. The esophagus might struggle to push food through the newly tightened area. So a surgeon might be more cautious, maybe suggest a partial wrap instead of a full one, or reconsider surgery altogether if the reserve is very poor.
Makes total sense. You don't want to trade reflux for difficulty swallowing.
Exactly.
What about just general advice, lifestyle things people with IEM can do?
Yeah, some general strategies can definitely help manage things day to day. Eating smaller meals more often rather than big, heavy ones.
Okay.
Chewing food really, really well. That makes the esophagus's job easier. Avoiding eating right before lying down is usually recommended. And sometimes people can identify specific foods that seem to trigger their symptoms more, so they can try to avoid those.
So it's quite personalized, finding what works for you.
Very much so. Treatment is tailored to the individual symptoms and test results.
You said it's an active research area.
Mm-hmm.
So what's new? What are researchers looking at now? Any exciting future directions?
Oh, definitely. This is where it gets quite promising, actually. First, the diagnostic criteria themselves are evolving. The next version, Chicago Classification 4.0, might adjust the definition, maybe requiring a higher percentage of ineffective swallows to make the diagnosis even more clinically relevant.
So refining who actually gets the label.
Kind of, yeah. And there's tons of research into the causes, what's really going on. People are looking at the vagus nerve's role, potential issues there. Changes in the esophageal microbiome, that community of bacteria and other microbes in the esophagus, is a hot topic. Could that affect motility?
Microbiome connection again. Seems to be everywhere.
It really does. Inflammation is another area of focus. And really digging into the meaning of that contraction reserve, we talked about how well does it predict long-term outcomes.
What about new diagnostic tools? You mentioned FLP.
Right. Tools like FLIP, measuring that stretchiness or distensibility, especially at the EGJ, esophagogastric junction, are adding a whole new dimension beyond just pressure. There's also impedance planimetry, another technique being developed that might give us a much better look at how the actual food bolus is moving or not moving.
Better ways to see what's really happening with the food.
Exactly, which could help predict who is likely to have symptoms and how bad they might be.
And treatments. Any new therapies being explored?
There is hope there, too. Certain medications called serotoninergic agents, these affect serotonin pathways in the gut, have shown some early promise in small studies. Drugs like buspirone, mosapride, prucalopride. Some research suggests they might improve esophageal motility,
right?
Yeah, it's still early days. We need larger, more focused studies specifically on IEM patients to really know if they work, for whom, and what the side effects might be long term.
Okay, so promising, but needs more research.
Definitely. And the search continues for better prokinetic drugs, ones that are maybe more targeted specifically to the esophageal smooth muscle.
It sounds like the goal is moving towards understanding IEM not as one single thing, but maybe different types.
Precisely. Researchers talk about identifying different phenotypes of IEM, maybe based on the HRM pattern, the symptoms, the presence of reflux, the contraction reserve, all these factors.
And if you can identify different types.
Then you can hopefully develop more targeted treatments for each type. Personalized medicine for esophageal motility. There's also more focus on understanding how other diseases like EoE or systemic conditions like scleroderma or even diabetes contribute to motility problems. It's all interconnected.
So the big picture is moving towards a much more tailored approach using all this different information.
That's the direction, absolutely. Combining HRM, maybe FelUp, symptom profiles, understanding underlying conditions to really guide treatment.
Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. If you had to give our listeners the main takeaways from this deep dive on IEM, what would they be?
All right, key points. One, IEM is actually found quite often on esophageal tests, but importantly, it doesn't always cause problems. Two, when it does cause symptoms, the diagnosis relies on specific measurements from high-resolution manometry, especially that DCI number. Three, right now there's no direct cure to strengthen the contractions, so treatment focuses on managing your specific symptoms like heartburn and any related conditions like reflux.
Okay.
And four, this is a really active area of research. New diagnostic tools are emerging, potential new therapies are being investigated, and the whole field is moving towards a much more personalized way of managing IEM.
That's a great summary. It really shows how much is involved in something seemingly simple like swallowing. And maybe a final thought for you, our listener, to ponder. Given that IEM can exist without you even knowing it, what might these subtle signals from our digestive system, how things are moving or not moving, be telling us about our overall health? Is there maybe a deeper link between, gut motility and our general well-being that science is only just starting to uncover? Something to think about. It definitely encourages you to stay curious about the incredible complexity inside your own body. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.